Good evening. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Scott Huntington. Dr. Huntington is an assistant professor of medicine at Yale, at the Yale School of Medicine, in the Division of Hematology, and he's here with me tonight to discuss hematologic malignancies, and particularly his interest in lymphoma. Scott, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's great to be here.
Scott, how did you get interested in blood malignancies, and how did you get interested in lymphoma?
Yeah, sure. So two major draws to the field. One came very early in medical education, where I had the opportunity to spend some time in a cancer clinic, a blood cancer clinic, and to witness those really rich and rewarding relationships between physicians and their patients in that rather difficult period of cancer diagnosis and really guiding them through the therapy was really a rewarding experience. And so that patient relationship really drew me to this this field, and at the same time, the science behind cancer and the science behind advancing our therapies for the cancer really was a twofold kind of link between the patients and the science. And there really wasn't no question early on that I wanted to be an oncologist and a blood cancer specialist. In terms of lymphoma, the real draw there is that lymphoma can impact patients of all ages, so I have a very diverse patient population, and the therapies are incredibly diverse, and so every day is something new, something exciting, and it's a very multidisciplinary field where we have our pathologist involved in terms of the diagnosis, we have our chemotherapy or therapies that we're recommending, and also radiation therapists as well kind of coming together, and so it's a really incredibly rewarding field to be in, and the scientific advances are really coming quickly. So that the therapy is changing and improving clinical outcomes for the better.
So is there more than one kind of lymphoma, not one unique disease?
Yeah, so lymphoma is the most common hematologic malignancy. So it's about 60% of all blood cancers. And in terms of blood cancers, that represents about 10% of cancers. So within blood cancers, lymphoma is the most common, and there are many different types of lymphomas. We typically categorize the more broad categorization to Hodgkin lymphoma and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Within Hodgkin lymphoma, there are a few different varieties. Most classically, patients present in their younger, either late adolescence or younger adulthood, whereas non-Hodgkin lymphoma can be further divided many, many times over into T cells and B cells, and within those, there's many different subdivisions. And the therapies really depend on what subtype of lymphoma that you have. And so the pathology diagnosis and the clinical diagnosis really come together to form what the therapeutic recommendations will be for our patients.
So how do patients find out that they have a lymphoma? Like, why would you think be worried about it, or how would you come to medical attention?
Sure. So the clinical presentation for lymphoma varies as well. And so there are very slow-growing, what we call indolent lymphomas or low-grade lymphomas, where a patient may be completely asymptomatic, and the diagnosis usually comes incidentally. And so that means on an annual physical exam, maybe a patient notices a lump, and their provider recognizes that this is a new lymph node that is enlarged, and that could lead to a diagnosis. Or potentially annual blood counts might be low, and so that could lead to further workup. And then finally, actually, it's quite common is that patients are getting imaging for other diseases or other etiologies, whether it be a kidney stone or appendicitis, and sure enough, there's some lymph nodes that are there on imaging, and further diagnosis could certainly define whether this could be an indolent lymphoma. On the other end of the spectrum are the more what we call aggressive or kind of high-tempo lymphomas, where patients really progress over weeks to months in terms of becoming symptomatic. And so the symptoms associated with that may be a rapidly enlarging node or lesion, profound fatigue or anemia, where someone might be short of breath, really having trouble getting up to kind of start their day. There's also risk for low platelet counts sometimes. So these are the cells that stop us from bleeding. So patients may have bruising or easy bleeding. And then finally, things like weight loss or poor appetite, a fever, chills, night sweats. Those are the classic symptoms associated with more kind of up-tempo or aggressive lymphoma.
And while those symptoms are scary, I think people get really frightened when they're losing weight and not trying to, or, you know, those night sweats, which can be so uncomfortable and everything. In some ways, you know, the other thing you were mentioning earlier about the low-grade lymphomas being found on a scan, what a scary thought that you could have these enlarged cancerous lymph nodes and not know about it. Isn't that something we should be scanned all the time for, to get them out as quickly as we can?
That's a really good question. So, in terms of indolent lymphomas, the classic tempo is that really these things are forming over years, typically. When they do form, usually they remain asymptomatic until they develop either the accumulation of cells that they're pushing on, an organ that may be of importance, or they're on the periphery, so we can feel these lymph nodes and they become the attention to the patient. The thing about indolent lymphoma is that these are very slow growing, and our therapies are highly effective, but the treatment actually can't get rid of all the lymphoma cells. So the indolent lymphomas generally are actually treated right before the patient becomes symptomatic. So if we identify it, we actually do this thing that we call active surveillance. And so we're looking at kind of the pace, defining the pace of the indolent lymphoma, and really trying to treat before a patient might become symptomatic. That's really in stark contrast to the more aggressive lymphomas, where these aggressive lymphomas, the cells are really all replicating, and so our traditional therapies that go after fast-dividing cells have the potential to get rid of all of them. And so we actually can cure a very a high number of aggressive lymphomas. And so as soon as an aggressive lymphoma is diagnosed, we are more apt to really try to treat this aggressively with treatment. And again, for the indolent lymphomas, commonly we do this thing called active surveillance, where we're really just watching the patient, which can be very difficult for someone that they're diagnosed with a new disease, they're told it's a cancer, but then we step back and say, we need to watch this.
Never mind, right?
Yeah. And, in some folks, we can watch this for years and years, and potentially they will never need therapy. And so that's the real quandary, is that we certainly want to treat patients if it's going to benefit them and improve their quality and quantity of life. But we also, recognizing that some patients actually may never need treatment, and we wouldn't want them to really have the experience of the side effects potential of our therapy. So it's a bit of a nuance, a balance, in terms of, in lymphoma, there's a really a large spectrum of clinical disease, and the therapies really range from watching to more intensive treatments.
So it sounds like, although you specialize in one particular group of cancers, which seems like it could be rather limited base of knowledge, in fact, you're dealing with dozens of different things that you need to know a lot about.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Fascinating. And is there any way in these lower grade lymphomas to study them to know which patients are more likely to have an earlier progression or more likely to never need to be treated? Is this something people are trying to figure out?
Sure, sure. So I guess we take a step back and discuss how we diagnose a lymphoma. So typically lymphomas, they do involve the lymph nodes. We do occasionally have what we call extranodal or lymphoma that affects outside the nodes. But really the way that we diagnose it is with a biopsy. So ideally, we take out the area of the lymph node, a small piece, to look at it under the microscope. That helps with the diagnosis. But there are a number of other things that we're learning about of lymphoma and cancer in general, which is really trying to figure out what are the drivers behind our cancers. And so in some lymphomas, we can actually find early drivers that may portend a more aggressive disease course, number one. And number two, we may find things that actually predict a response to one therapy or the other. So within a single type of lymphoma, we're further subcharacterizing based on kind of the molecular markers, and that really is going to have a pretty large impact on treatment going forward, helping stratify risk, but also trying to predict which therapy is the correct approach for an individual patient. So personalized medicine is really coming to lymphoma at a rapid pace.
Hmm. So are these tests that can be helpful in choosing therapies, selecting therapies, or in terms of prognostication, are they now standard part of diagnostic workups in most pathology labs?
They're growing. Yes, they're growing phenomenon. Really, not only in academic center but outside. Where, for instance, for chronic lymphocytic leukemia or small lymphocytic lymphoma, there are genetic either mutations or what we call translocations that are basically rearrangements of common proteins. That really should be being done in all patients with diagnosis because they really have a large impact on therapeutic choices, not only on risk stratification, but really patients with a certain type of CLL seem not to respond as well to chemotherapy and really should be getting novel, what we call novel or oral agents that are more targeting the drivers behind the CLL as opposed to traditional chemotherapy, which is really about going after cells that are dividing. And leading to cell death that way.
And when you say drivers, you're talking about mutated protein genes and proteins that biologically affect the cells, is that right?
Exactly, yeah. So in terms of many lymphomas, the major driver is a downstream of what we call the B-cell receptor. And so many of these genetic aberrations are basically driving the B-cell to replicate, to continue to accumulate, as opposed to what's supposed to happen is that these cells eventually have a switch that allows them to die. And so the on switch is basically left on, and these new treatments are trying to kind of sequel and squash that on switch. And
turn the on switch off.
Exactly, yeah.
Forgive my ignorance, but what's a B-cell, Scott?
Yeah, so in terms of lymphoma, we classically subdivide into two, so T cells and B cells. B cells are really all about on the path towards what we call antibodies, which are what our body makes in response to seeing proteins that they don't like. So
like infections.
Infections, vaccines. So when you get your annual influenza shot or your Pneumovax, it's really about the B cells making an antibody response. The T cells, on the other hand, are a very diverse field of lymphocytes that have a number of functions in terms of allergies, in terms of kind of allowing us to see the world in kind of the correct way. So not over reacting to every food antigen, but also in controlling when things get out of hand or have damage, cell damage. The T cells are really important, and so both T cells and B cells can lead to lymphoma, and the therapy for those are quite different, that's kind of the difference between B and T cells.
Gotcha. So when you're talking about these B cell lymphomas, you're talking about lymphomas that are related to these antibody forming cells or the precursors to the antibody cells.
Exactly.
Is that right? Okay, gotcha. How is the field changing? You mentioned that there are new treatments or oral treatments.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on that's new and how would people know about that stuff?
Sure. So I think the major driver of clinical changing and what we're doing for our patients is better understanding of the disease in themselves. So recognizing that a given what we thought was one kind of basket of lymphoma diagnosis is really a number of subclassifications where there's different drivers within the lymphoma. In recognizing that, we're able to bring in different therapies to either target that driver or combining our traditional therapies to really improve both the responses, so getting into a nicer response or deeper response, and hopefully increasing the chance of cure for many of our patients.
Well, this is a really fascinating area, Scott, and I'm going to want to pick up on this after our break. But at this moment, we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about lymphoma with our guest, Dr. Scott Huntington. Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I've been talking tonight with my guest, Dr. Scott Huntington, about lymphoma, the different kinds of lymphoma, and their genetic drivers and new treatments. Scott, before the break, you were telling me that the new development in treatments for lymphoma have come from a better understanding of the biology of the different subsets of lymphoma. Could you walk me through some interesting examples or an interesting example of that?
Yeah, sure. So in the more aggressive lymphomas where we have therapies that are highly effective and can cure a good percentage of folks, we've recognized that there are two major classifications of this diffuse large, what we call diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And for many years, we've recognized that some folks may not respond to our traditional therapy, which combines what we call immunotherapy, which is kind of making our immune system recognize these cells as abnormal, with traditional chemotherapies. And in doing so, we're able to identify a subset of what we call activated B-cell lymphomas, which may not respond as well to the traditional therapy that really has been a standard therapy. And so now we're moving towards adding new therapies to the kind of backbone, mm-hmm. and early data suggests that that's really going to be beneficial and hopefully improve the outcomes to the levels that we were seeing in the non-activated B-cell forms. And so that's one area where we recognize that there were patients that weren't responding as well as others, and then delving down to see what's the difference between these two. And then on top of that, bringing in recognizing that these patients may have different kind of drivers, and adding medications to basically target those. So new oral medications that look effective in that, and also kind of more older kind of immunotherapies or IMIDs that look very effective. And so that really has been happening in the last few years, that we're changing the way that we've been treating patients for really decades, in recognizing that we may have better ways going forward. So that's really one exciting area. In terms of other really exciting therapies, immunotherapy clearly is a hot topic really through all of cancer. In addition to diseases like melanoma and lung cancers, bladder cancers, where immunotherapy seems to be growing in terms of effectiveness. In terms of Hodgkin lymphoma, we've seen similar, really wildly successful results from these medications that we like to term checkpoint inhibitors. And the idea behind that is that cancer cells are abnormal, and there's a chance that our immune system, kind of at baseline, may be recognizing these cells as abnormal. But there may be some other inhibitory stimuli towards our own immune system. And so these agents that we term checkpoint inhibitors are really turning off that inhibitory signal and allowing our primed immune response to go after our tumor cells. And in Hodgkin lymphoma, this looks like it's going to be a really successful area. And as we move forward, immunotherapy may come up front to really change the way that we treat many Hodgkin lymphomas. And so with the success of that, we're looking at it in other lymphomas, follicular lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and even outside of lymphoma, we're looking at it in leukemias and multiple myeloma. And so that's really a fascinating field. Recognizing our immune system may already have kind of a response, a primed response, and trying to unleash that response. On the kind of further end of the spectrum, if our own immune system is not recognizing a cancer as abnormal, is there anything that we could do to potentially to basically charge our immune system after cancers, and blood cancers in particular? And this is where the field of chimeric antigen receptor T cells are coming
in. Whoa, what was that? Yes. Chimeric?
Yeah, so chimeric antigen receptor T cells. And so the idea behind this is really fascinating. T cells had the capacity to really target to target a cell, to target and lead to cell death. And if our own body isn't able to recognize a cancer as abnormal, could we maybe take our own immune system and charge it towards the cancer? And this has been done for many blood cancers, with the primary data coming from these chimeric antigen receptor T cells, or CAR T cells.
CAR T cells, I like saying that better.
Yeah, CAR T cells towards B cell cancers. So things like chronic lymphocytic lymphoma, things like ALL, so actually pediatric, so young patients have had really wonderful responses to the therapies. And the experience, it looks very promising, and hopefully will be available to many patients going forward. So really, as we understand more about the cancer, we're trying to figure out, are there ways that we can stop the driving forces behind the cancer? Many times these are oral medications. The immunotherapy, that checkpoint inhibition, we're really trying to release our own immune system that's already primed. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we're trying to actually take our immune system and educate it against our own cancer. And so those three fields are really developing at a rapid pace and are likely to change the way that we treat cancer going forward.
Fascinating. So, you know, I think a lot of patients, you know, they're not feeling well, they've had weight loss, night sweats, there's been a lymph node biopsy, an oncologist tells them, well, you have lymphoma, and, you know, it seems to me that oftentimes the patient may be presented with a treatment plan. It seems, from what you're telling me, like the patient should maybe expect to hear, well, you've got this kind of lymphoma, or we did these kinds of studies which specify this treatment over that. But I mean, it must be hard for patients. First of all, patients don't really have this information, right? So how do you know if you're getting the right treatment?
Yeah, so that's a really, really important question. So the diagnosis is one that is, it's really important, because clearly the diagnosis is what drives the treatment, and we hope that the proper diagnosis leads to the most optimal treatment. You know, having your pathology, so your tissue reviewed at a center where they actually see many, many lymphomas and can further subclassify. We commonly see cases in our pathology here where if something isn't clear, the provider or the pathologist, referring pathologist, may actually send the tissue to a academic center for a second opinion. And so not only are we seeing in lymphoma second opinions clinically for treatment variation, but actually getting the diagnosis right is vitally important. And so second opinions for pathologic review are actually quite important. So you know, just talking with a provider and saying, is this a classic case of X disease? Does everything make sense? Is there anything that doesn't align? And if things don't align, you know, asking for, you know, could we send this test, or could we send this to a second pathology review, could really be, I think, a benefit for patients.
So sometimes a second opinion is important, whether it's actually showing up at a center yourself or at least having your pathology reviewed.
Yeah, and I think in many cancers, we find that the multidisciplinary approach is really the way to go. So to have the things that we call tumor boards, where presentation of more challenging cases are presented, to really get the input of many clinicians, many pathologists, so really that the diagnosis solidified, and that can also be very, very helpful for many cases.
And is radiation sometimes still a part of the therapy?
Yeah, so radiation is part of a therapy in some folks with lymphoma. Radiation is a local treatment. You know, we classically think that many lymphomas are kind of systemic or blood treatment, blood cancers at time of diagnosis. But if lymphoma is caught in an early stage where there are only one or two regions of the lymphoma, radiation, a local therapy, can be highly effective and certainly is used in many, many forms of lymphoma, more commonly in things like Hodgkin lymphoma.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes stem cell transplantation is used, is that right?
Exactly, yeah. So stem cell transplant is sometimes used following a good response to first-line therapy. So if a patient has a disease that we think may benefit from higher dose therapy, we commonly will refer to our stem cell experts, where they provide patients with kind of a higher dose treatment, and then basically to allow that to be safe, give them their own stem cells that were previously collected back. And so we call that a high-dose therapy with stem cell rescue or an autologous transplant. And then in some lymphomas, many of the T-cell lymphomas in particular, it looks like stem cell transplant using someone else's stem cells may be a benefit. So actually, the idea behind that is having someone's immune system in your body may help eradicate any of the last kind of lymphoma cells that may be remaining prior to the transplant. So that's an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And there definitely is a role for both of those in some patients with lymphoma.
Complicated field you're in, my friend.
It's an exciting, but it can be a challenging at times. And having a good team of pathologists, radiologists, and radiation oncologists alongside is really quite important.
Mm. Now, Scott, I know one of your passions and interests is has to do with looking at issues, medical issues, in particular around lymphoma, but maybe not exclusively the lymphoma, at a more global level. Higher than individual patients or individual treatments. Can you tell me something about that?
So in terms of my research interests, I really have two hats. One is clinical research in trying to make sure that our patients here at Yale have access to the most novel, innovative, and promising clinical trials. And so that's one major interest. And the other is, at the end of the spectrum, really ensuring that these medical advances that we're making are able to be translated globally to the population in the United States. I think we all recognize that cancer care and cancer treatments in particular have increased in costs over the last decade or so. And we're recognizing that with higher costs and different differences in insurances, that maybe patients are having a burden, financial burden, or having difficult access to treatment. And so my research in that realm is really trying to focus on addressing that access issue, addressing how cancer care is covered in terms of insurance providers, and really trying to make sure that care is equitable going forward. Because we have all these really exciting therapies that I'm very enthusiastic that we're developing, but if we're unable to translate that into the population and improve clinical outcomes and cancer outcomes globally, I think that would be a real loss in terms of a challenge that we need to overcome, but really would be a travesty that we really shouldn't jeopardize.
So how do you go about studying that?
Yeah, so in terms of real-world outcomes, we're entering the era of big data, and so looking at what is actually going on the ground, so to speak. So we have access to kind of large databases of patient claims, so in terms of what treatment they received, how they received it. In looking at that, looking at differences in access or therapeutic options based on what sort of insurance a patient has potentially, or what sort of out-of-pocket costs a patient has, can really be telling in terms of what sort of access issues or insurance design issues that we may be able to address to ensure that care is equitable going forward.
So I guess we won't have time to get into the issue about whether we'd have a more equitable system in the United States were there not so many different kinds of healthcare coverage, but that gets into politics. And unfortunately, while of great interest, we don't have time for that conversation, but maybe next time. Scott, this has been a really terrific discussion about your passionate interest in lymphoma. And we're so glad to have you on the faculty. As I haven't mentioned that Scott joined us just about a year ago and is doing great things at the Smilow Cancer Hospital and the Yale Cancer Center. So Scott, it was really great having you here on Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I hope you'll come back soon. This has been a terrific show discussing lymphoma. Until next week, this is Dr. Stephen Gore wishing you all a safe and healthy week.